Well, good evening. Have your Bibles open to Matthew chapter 24. If you've been keeping up with the news at all, you know that in recent weeks, a reincarnation of the Left Behind series has come out in theaters. The Left Behind series of books was written by a man named Tim LaHaye, and it is a rather long series of Christian fiction novels that detail the accounts of those who are left behind after the tribulation. They are in the midst of the rapture. They are in the midst of the 7 years of tribulation, facing a new world order, an organization that is bent on destruction and mayhem and that sort of thing. All things that make for very, very good fiction, though not very good Bible understanding. Of course, the latest rendition has Nicolas Cage, so it's got to be good, right? When has he ever failed us? For those not familiar with premillennialism, this is a chart, I think, that kind of sums up pretty easily, and you're thinking, uh-oh, it's a sermon with charts. Watch out. He's pulling charts out. Don't worry. This is the only chart I'm going to do. Everything else is pretty pictures. But if you're not familiar with premillennialism is the idea, the interpretation of things presented in the Bible, wherein, as you can see here, at the end of the church age in which we are living, that's why they call it premillennialism, because we're in the age that is before the millennium, the thousand-year reign of Jesus Christ. At the end of the church age, there's going to be an event called the rapture, where all the good people in the world who God wants to be saved are suddenly going to disappear before everybody's eyes. They'll vanish. Little babies from nurseries are just going to disappear. Your best friend who's a Christian is just going to disappear. Your cab driver is going to disappear all of a sudden. Or in the Left Behind series of novels, your co-pilot on a jetliner is just going to disappear from before your eyes, and you're going to have to try and land a plane on your own through chaos. And all the good people in the world, all the Christians, are going to disappear, and they're going to be raptured to go enjoy the presence of God for 7 years, while everybody else who's in the world gets to spend 7 years living through a veritable misery. It'll be 7 years of chaos. There'll be warfare. There'll be a new world order, a world government that's going to take over the world. And Satan in disguise is going to be the ruler of that world government. At the end of those 7 years, those who have converted to Jesus Christ are then going to enjoy an opportunity to join him. Those who refused Jesus Christ during that 7 years are going to be lost in the battle of Armageddon. The Antichrist is going to fall, and he's going to be bound for 1,000 years, a la Revelation chapter 20. For 1,000 years, Jesus, yes, the Jesus we read about in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, is going to come back in the flesh and reign from a throne in the city of Jerusalem. Yes, the actual city of Jerusalem, on an actual throne. And he's going to be basically the president of the world for 1,000 years. It's going to be a very peaceful 1,000 years. Things are going to be great. Wars and disease are going to be all but done away with. And at the end of that 1,000 years, Satan is going to be loosed for a brief period of time to wreak havoc in the world, at which point the judgment day is actually going to happen. And finally, the saints get to go to heaven after 1,007 years of basically being in limbo. That's premillennialism. One of the hallmark texts of premillennialism is Matthew chapter 24, which is going to be the subject of our lesson this evening. In Matthew chapter 24, we are given an account of things as they happen at the destruction of Jerusalem. Though the language in Matthew chapter 24 is problematic, because as you read it, it's a chapter full of symbols. It's a chapter that envisions great wrath, that envisions the sun and the moon and the stars being darkened. Jesus Christ coming back, his vision on the clouds. People are going to be left behind. Others are going to be taken. There's going to be destruction. There's going to be doom, wars, rumors of wars, famines. And as you read Matthew 24, if you don't have the historical context in your mind already, it would be very easy to read that chapter and go, wow, this is certainly talking about some worldwide chaos, isn't it? I wonder if it's talking about all that Left Behind jazz I've been reading about lately. Because, you know, that's how people talk to themselves as they're reading their newspapers in the morning with a cup of coffee. Some things, though, about Matthew chapter 24 that we need to keep in mind here as we get into the text. It is symbolic. And symbolism is always a little challenging if you don't understand the keys. You know when you're looking at a map? And they teach you this in like first grade, don't they? When you're looking at a map, there's a thing called a legend down in the bottom corner, or a key sometimes is what it's called. And it gives you the explanation for various symbols that you see on that map. What does a dotted line mean? What does a solid line mean? What does a solid dot mean? It's those sorts of things. If you don't know what the legend is or what the key is, you're going to have a very hard time interpreting the symbols that you see on that map. The same is true with prophetic language in the Bible. If you don't know what the symbols mean, if you don't understand the key or the legend, a lot of the things that you see in a chapter like Matthew 24 are going to be astounding and confounding at the same time. So let's first of all establish a timeline here for our chapter 24 musings. The first thing that you'll notice from Matthew 24 as far as establishing a timeline is verse 34, which says, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." So no matter how much mental dexterity you have to go through, no matter how many hoops you have to jump through to make your preconception fit the text, the reality is that Jesus comes right out and says, all the stuff that we're talking about on the Olivet Discourse, all the stuff from Matthew 24 is going to happen within the lifespan of those who are alive right now. All of these things are going to happen within this generation. And let's not get crazy here, people. Let's not try to interpret generation as something other than generation. A lot of people look at the word generation and say, well, he's not talking about generation. He's talking about a class of people. As in, Christians as a class of people are always going to exist until these things take place or before these things are concluded. No, generation is generation, okay? Generation is generation. All these things are going to take place within the lifespan of those living right now, Jesus says. And it's important to realize that timetable. I think it's important also that Jesus himself says, see to it that no one misleads you in this text. It's important to be kind of wary of strange interpretations. As you're reading prophetic literature, if something doesn't sound right, if something smells kind of fishy, Jesus is warning you. Make sure no one misleads you. Make sure no one misleads you. So let's read a few verses here. Let's go into Matthew chapter 24. Let's start in verses 1 through 3, okay? Matthew chapter 24, verses 1 through 3. And Jesus came out of the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he answered and said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down." And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And it is at that point, with that question in mind, that Jesus begins his discourse in verse 4. There's some really important facts that need to be established then. What does context tell you? Context tells you that the city of Jerusalem is what is in question right now. Context tells you they've been looking at the temple. They've basically been sightseeing around the big city, looking at the buildings and the temple over here and this wall and this gate over here. And that is what the context is. And with that as the backdrop, with the very temple in the background of their conversation, Jesus says, not a single stone that you see will be left on top of another here when this goes down. Not a single stone. So are we talking about the tribulation here? Because it sure seems like a lot of structures are still left behind. Jerusalem is the thing that's in mind here. It's destruction. It's judgment. So they ask a question, really, three questions, specific to Jerusalem. When will these things be? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Does he say end of the world? I think it's important to point that out also. Is he talking about the end of the world here or the end of the age? We'll keep that in mind. Kind of log that away. Let's move on to verse 4 now. Now that we've established kind of a timetable here. Pick up in verse 4 if you'd like to follow along. And Jesus answered and said to them, "See to it that no one misleads you, because that will be a temptation. For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will mislead many. And you will hear, you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not frightened, for those things must take place. But that is not yet the end. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. But all these things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Then they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you, and you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And at that time many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. And many, many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. And because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all the nations. And then the end shall come." All right, it's important that the disciples guard themselves against deception. That's a big part of this. Watch out for anybody who's promoting kind of a sign of the times message. When you see the street preachers down at ASU's campus, right, John? When you see the street preachers down there and they got their sign that says, "The end is near, the end is near." Jesus is kind of warning you, saying, I'd be very careful of that. Make sure that nobody misleads you. Now, he goes on and talks about wars and rumors of wars and famines and earthquakes. He says, there's going to be all this stuff, and people are going to say, it's a sign. It's a sign of the times. It's a sign that the end is coming. You know what Jesus' response to that is? He basically says, when there are wars and rumors of wars, when there are famines and earthquakes, that's actually just the world operating normally. That's what he basically says. Don't be shocked by those things. Don't be startled by them. When there's war and famine and earthquakes, that's basically just the world operating as normal. And I actually kind of take it the opposite of the premillennialist. The premillennialist looks at wars in the Middle East, and they look at earthquakes around the world, and they say, things are building up. They're building up. I actually look at calamities and take it as almost, in a twisted sort of way, of course, almost a comfort to know the world is just operating normal. That is just kind of like baseline operation for the world. An earthquake is not a shocking thing. An earthquake just means that things are just happening just the way they're supposed to. Tectonic plate activity. Hurricanes don't bother me at all. Hurricanes don't scare me because the world has hurricanes. It always has had hurricanes, and until the end of the world, it always will have hurricanes. Wars? People are always going to fight wars. That's how it always is. And if you're looking at wars in the Middle East right now, thinking that this is somehow like boiling over, you have not read much in history books. Because the world has always been at a boiling point. For all of human history, we have been at a boiling point. So Jesus is basically saying, this is just the world operating normally. Don't listen to people when they say these are signs of the times. Rather, you need to be preparing yourself. When you hear of wars and rumors of wars and earthquakes and famines, that's nothing but an indication that the world is actually coming for you. Because the very next thing he talks about is tribulation. They'll deliver you to tribulation. Now, he's not talking like the premillennialist model. He's not talking about unbelievers who will become believers during the tribulation. He's talking about people who enter the tribulation who are already believers. You are already believers, and you are the ones facing tribulation. This idea of the rapture, of like little babies and Christians and priests and everybody, of them just like disappearing and getting to skip out on the whole 7 years of tribulation. Jesus is actually saying, no, it's those people who are going to be facing the tribulation. They will be persecuted. You, the saints. We don't get to skip the tribulation. We are the tribulation. Right now is the tribulation. Christians in the Philippines are facing the tribulation. Christians in the Middle East are facing the tribulation. The tribulation is every age in which Christians have lived and been persecuted by those who are not Christians. That's the tribulation. So there's just some things here that just, they don't fit. Just some things that don't match up properly. So if Matthew chapter 24 is not talking about the end of the world or the tribulation, what is it talking about? Let's pick up in verse 4 now. Let's keep reading here. In verse 15. Let's keep reading in verse 15. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. Pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him, for false Christs and false prophets will arise. They'll show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he is in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe them. For just as the lightning comes forth from the east and flashes even to the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. So now Jesus is answering the second part of their question, isn't he? What will be the sign of your coming? He touches on his coming here, doesn't he, in the second half of this passage that we just read? When you see these things, you'll know that I'm coming now. You'll know that I'm coming. What is the abomination of desolation in verse 15? What is that? The abomination of desolation doesn't have to be a confusing thing. We kind of look at it and say, oh, what's the symbolism there? We've got to go back to Daniel. Like the writer says, go back to Daniel. What's he talking about there? The abomination of desolation spoken of within the context in Daniel is actually talking about profaning the temple in Jerusalem. That's what it's talking about. It's the profaning of the temple in Jerusalem. It's destruction. Look at Luke chapter 21. Luke 21 is Luke's account of the Olivet Discourse. Same speech, different perspective. Okay? Same speech, different perspective. Look in Luke 21, verses 20 and 21. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is at hand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of the city depart. Let not those who are in the country enter the city. This is the same thing, isn't it? If you line up Luke 21 and Matthew chapter 24, the same speech, when you start lining up the details here, if verse 21 corresponds to verse 16, then that means verse 20 corresponds to verse 15 in Matthew 24. Where Matthew uses a symbolic term that says the abomination of desolation, Luke just comes right out and says the literal. Matthew says abomination of desolation. Luke just comes out and says, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, that's all it means. The abomination of desolation is the coming of the destruction of the temple. When you see Rome coming around the bend, they are coming to defile the temple in Jerusalem. When you see Rome coming around the bend, you better get out of town. That's what Jesus is saying. When you see Rome coming, you flee to the mountains. Get out of Jerusalem because they won't spare you. They're not going to spare you. And history shows that they did not spare Jerusalem. Man, Titus showed up. Titus shows up and he lays that city bare. Just like Jesus says, not one stone on top of the other. Temple burned to the ground. People killed, slaughtered by the hundreds and even thousands. It was a merciless destruction. And the Jews never recovered from it. The war that followed that was one that was also quite merciless. This was one of the last times in Rome's history that they really had to come down hard on the Jews. And after that, after this war, it was not the same. And I think that's what Jesus means here when he talks about a tribulation's going to come, a tribulation that you've never seen and that you'll never see again. Think of it this way. Until this point in 70 AD, when Jerusalem is destroyed, had the Jews always kind of bounced back? Yeah, pretty much. They kind of bounced back. Hey, yeah. You know, the Assyrians come right up to the gate in Hezekiah's time, and the Assyrians are wiped out by an angel of the Lord. Hezekiah is saved. They bounce back from that. The Babylonian captivity. They kill the king. Nebuchadnezzar burns Jerusalem to the ground. And then, you know, when the Persians take power over Babylon, they send the Jews back. And the Jews rebuild the city. Nehemiah rebuilds the walls. Ezra rebuilds the temple. Okay, and they kind of bounce back from that. Okay? Even in the intertestamental period, that 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament, they find a number of wars there. Josephus does a great job of recounting these events here in the intertestamental period. And they bounce back again. They bounce back. They've always bounced back when God's judgment came upon them. But there was something different about 70 AD. There's something different about that last war that they fought. And you can go to Jerusalem today and see that something's different there. Where once there was a temple to the Almighty God, what stands is the Dome of the Rock now, an Islamic shrine. They never recovered from 70 AD. And I think that's what Jesus means by this tribulation, is it's a tribulation that you've never seen before, and it's a tribulation that will be like no other. It's a tribulation that you are never going to see again in the same way. Sadly for the premillennialists, there's just too much in this text that doesn't make any sense at all within the framework of their eschatology. When you look at that diagram they looked at the beginning of the lesson, there's just some things that don't fit. When you read in Matthew 24 and Jesus talks about, and let's hope that this tribulation doesn't happen with people who have nursing babies. And you're like, hold on a second. I thought all the babies got taken away in the rapture. I thought the babies got taken away. If the rapture took all the innocent people, including the babies, then why are there babies here that you're having a nurse during the tribulation? How about the elect? He mentions the elect. For the sake of the elect? Well, hold on. Didn't all the elect get taken away in the rapture? What are the elect doing right here, right in the middle of the tribulation? There's just some things that don't fit the premillennial framework. And I think that's something that the premillennialist just has to acknowledge. Well, then he gets on here and he uses a terminology here near the end of our context here in verse 27. For just as the lightning comes forth from the east and flashes the west, so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. What does he mean by that there? Well, what typically comes from the east if you're living in Jerusalem? Rome. That's where Rome comes from. The coming of the Son of Man is not one of the end of the world, but the coming of the Son of Man is one in judgment. Jesus is using the Romans to judge Jerusalem. And that's the whole point of this passage. He's judging Jerusalem here. The coming of the Son of Man is the coming of Rome. It's the same language that we've seen throughout the Old Testament, by the way. You're always seeing God saying the great day of the Lord. What's the great day of the Lord? It's not the end of the world. You read Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, any one of the prophets, and when they talk about the great and terrible day of the Lord, the coming of the day of the Lord, the coming of the Son of Man, they're not talking about the end of the world. They're talking about the end of an era. They're talking about a judgment against Babylon, against Assyria, a judgment against Jerusalem or Judea, a judgment against the northern tribes in Israel. It's always a judgment against specific people, specific nations in a specific time period. And it's the same way here. Let's keep reading, though. We're running out of time in our lesson. I do want to move on here a little bit. What's the significance of Jerusalem? Because I think what sometimes people will say is, so you're telling me all of Matthew 24, all of this elegant, sweeping language is just about the destruction of one city. all of this lightning coming from the east and flashing in the west, and the Son of Man coming on a cloud, and the abomination of desolation, and people being taken and people being left behind, and all of this massive, sweeping, epic language is just the destruction of one city? I say yes. Because Jerusalem was not just any city. It was not just any city. If you really wanted to impress upon Americans the fear of your cause, what are you going to blow up? You going to blow up a warehouse in Topeka? Or are you going to blow up the World Trade Center in New York? You know, those two towers, they weren't just two towers. They weren't just two random buildings on September 11th. Those buildings were representative of something. Think, what do they want to blow up? They want to blow up two towers in New York. They want to blow up the Pentagon. They wanted to blow up the White House. They're not just picking random houses, random buildings. Those two towers were more than just two buildings to America. Jerusalem was not just any city. So yes, Matthew 24 is about the destruction of just one little city. And not even a very big city at that. Just one city. But when you read in the prophets of the Old Testament, what does Jerusalem represent? Every time Jerusalem is spoken of, he's not talking about just a city. Jerusalem becomes the symbol of a nation, the symbol of a religion, the symbol of a people. And when he says, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, he's not talking about buildings. He's talking about the symbol there. Jerusalem's destruction was the end of an era. And that's part of the question that the disciples ask him way back in verse 3. What is the sign of the end of the age? What could possibly signal the end of the Jewish age more than the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem? The sacking of their capital city, never to be rebuilt the same way ever again. What could signal the end of an age more than that? So yeah, just one city, sure. But probably the most important city in Israel's entire history. He goes on to say, though, beginning in verse 29, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. He will send forth his angels with a great trumpet. They will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. So surely we're talking about the end of the world here, aren't we? I mean, come on, that's got to be end of the world stuff, isn't it? No. Still not the end of the world. Remember, all of this is qualified by verse 34. Truly, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. So unless Jesus is making a seriously anachronistic statement, we still have to keep things under the umbrella of this generation in the first century. So what does it mean then when he talks about the sun will be dark and the moon will not give its light? Is that literally talking about the sun being dark and the moon not giving its light? Or is this symbolic language that's supposed to make us go back to the Old Testament for a little indication? Several passages here. I just give you a couple of examples, though there are numerous others if you're curious. I'd like you to write them down because we are running out of time here. I don't want to go over too much on a kind of a heavy, dry subject. There's only so much dry bread you can eat in one evening, right? But I would recommend that you read a number of these. Look at the language that's used. In particular, this passage in Isaiah 13. I love this passage in Isaiah 13 because it's speaking at the beginning of the context in verse 1 saying, now concerning Babylon, not the whole world, not the destruction of the world, but Babylon. And read the kind of language in verses 1 through 11. Sun being darkened, earth being shaken, mountains melting before God's eyes. That stuff didn't literally happen. Same is true of chapter 29, verse 6, chapter 50, verse 3, Joel, chapter 2, verses 28 through 32. God uses dramatic language to convey an idea. He uses the language of natural cataclysm to convey the idea of judgment. That I am going to say the sun and the moon being darkened, the stars falling from the heavens, earthquakes and everything. I'm going to use that language to indicate how cataclysmic my judgment is going to be. My judgments will come upon you like stars falling from the heavens, like the sun and the moon being darkened. That is how significant the judgment is going to be. So I still think we're not talking about the end of the world. The angels will go forth to collect his elect. Angel just means messenger. That's what the word means. The angels aren't going to have to collect people from the four winds when it comes to the end of the world. They're not going to have to collect people. We're going to hear the trumpets. We will need no collecting. We will walk out in the parking lot and know that God is coming back. The end of the world is going to come. The angels aren't going to collect people from the four winds. I think those angels are messengers. I think it's the gospel. I know that this is a difficult subject. And I know that we want to fixate on this term left behind here in verses 36 through 42. That one man will be taken from the field, another will be left behind. One person will be sleeping in a bed, and the other will be left behind. And we like to kind of fixate on that term, left behind, because it's dramatic. It makes for good storytelling. But that's all it is. Left behind is just storytelling. It's just storytelling. Part of the appeal, by way of conclusion, part of the appeal to premillennialism is that it offers a second chance at salvation. That if you couldn't become a Christian now, in this life, the rapture's going to come, and there's going to be 7 years of tribulation that will be your last shot at changing. And if those 7 years of tribulation can't convert you, well, then God is totally justified in condemning you to eternal hell. But there's an appeal there that says, if I can't make it here, maybe I can get a second chance in the tribulation and become a Christian then. We love our second chances, don't we? The second chance is now, though. And when you read about the language of Jesus in John 5, verses 26 through 29, for example, Jesus doesn't need a fancy diagram to explain end times. His eschatology is straightforward. You are living right now. You are living right now with the opportunity to be saved. If you reject this opportunity, if you reject the gospel in this life, there will come a day, a truly great and terrible day, when the good will be parted on the right, the evil will go to the left. One to a life, one to eternal death. That's your opportunity right now. You don't need a second chance. Take advantage of the chance that you have right now. So whatever need you have, please come forward as we stand and sing.